listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Russia Today and Sputnik have been influential outlets that have, several times, spoken mistruths about me and my campaign.
That was the current president of France, Emmanuel Macron, speaking earlier this week and alleging that Russian media outlets RT and Sputnik were agents of the state who peddle fake news with a political agenda.
That's why they were not invited to my headquarters. All media, including Russian, had access to my campaign. Russia Today and Sputnik have not behaved as media outlets and journalists, but as organs of influence and false propaganda.
In Germany also, the alleged role of Russian media in that country's elections is still being bandied about. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel has been in the difficult process of trying to form a government. We discussed all of that with a journalist from Sputnik. He's a frequent contributor to CPR News, Moscow-based journalist Dmitry Babich. Dmitry, Macron, French media, they're going crazy. It's like some kind of infection jumped off an airplane from Washington or something and has infected the brains of the people in Paris.
Well, that's true. Mr. Macron, he has been surprising a lot of people since the start of his, the sudden start of his political career. Just a year and a half ago, very few people knew about his existence. And he is a classical example of how the globalized media can create characters, you know, that the whole world would be looking at, you know. Suddenly, out of nowhere, this small banker who worked for the Rothschild Bank and then who served on secondary roles in the previous French government, suddenly he becomes the savior of France from the alt-right and extreme left danger, you know. He defeats a much more sensible candidate, François Fillon, who was actually destroyed again by the globalized media, which blew out of all proportion. A scandalous story of his wife getting some extra payments. It's just amazing. You can bomb other countries like Mr. Sarkozy and still be a candidate, right. But your wife should not get any salaries.
Right.
From any entity that you have something to do with. That's a grave, grave crime. You can kill thousands of people in Libya and plunge the country into a civil war, as Nicolas Sarkozy did, and still you will be a respected person.
That's right.
It also reminds me of the American media. If you watch the American media, you might think that unwanted kissing is a much more grave offense than unwanted bombing right. by Mr. Obama. You know, unwanted right. kissing from Mr. Weinstein, that is horrible. You know, that is the new Hiroshima, that is the new kind of chemical attack.
Right.
And a few bombs from Mr. Obama for democratization in places like Libya or Afghanistan or Iraq, yeah. That's just fine, you know.
Right. I know, it's you know, you have a body count in the case of, you know, these. I mean, look, the wars that have gone on from, let's just start with George Bush Jr., you know, forgetting, you know, we could go back to, there's still enough prep. Jimmy Carter started the war in Afghanistan in 1979, so, you know, how far back do you want to go? But, you know, there's a million or two or three or four people that are dead in the last 18 years as a consequence of U.S. policy, which, as it turns out, was done illegally with respect to the U.N. Charter and also with respect to U.S. law, although no one has, you know, really been interested in speaking up on that point from inside the U.S. government. George Bush never had to resign from anything. Barack Obama never had to resign from anything. Hillary Clinton, Donald Rumsfeld, all these people, they got to serve out their terms and they're drawing pensions now. They are not driven out like, say, Al Franken or Moore, disgraced as some kind of child molester, whatever. Now, look, I'm not saying that the problem of patriarchy, of male sexual privilege and assault isn't a problem. But the way the media is treating these things, it is a problem several orders of magnitude greater than mass murder. And for some reason, I have a problem with that.
You're right. You're right. And, you know, let me just correct you in one point. I don't think that all the wars come from the United States government alone. You know, like I don't see America as somehow worse than Western Europe.
You mentioned Sarkozy. You mentioned Sarkozy, for example. He's a bad actor.
The problem is not with nations. The problem is with ideologies. You know, the modern Western ideology, which I call ultra-liberalism, I don't like the word neoliberalism because neo is just something new, you know. The problem with the modern Western ideology is that it takes sound ideas, such as the equality of genders, for example, and just drives them to absurdity. Usually in the interests of so-called international business, or rather global business, you know, huge corporations. And sound ideas suddenly become hollow and even dangerous, you know, when they're interpreted by these new masters of the Western world. So let me just tell you about Macron, you know, what he did in the beginning of January. Yeah. Very few people noticed it in the United States, of course. In Russia, it was noticed because Macron lashed out at Russian propaganda. He was obviously having in mind the journalists of RT, previously Russia Today, and Sputnik, the two Russian media outlets where foreigners are also employed. But he was speaking to French journalists, and I think what he said, it deserves to be quoted in full. Let me quote him. "It is you, the journalists, who are the first victims of this propaganda. This propaganda imitates your tone of speech. It may even adopt your formats. It uses your vocabulary. Sometimes it may even recruit its employees among you. But in reality, these people are very different from you. And in the end, their propaganda flourishes on the confusion which we have ourselves gradually accepted." End of quote. Well, when I first heard it, I just thought, what does it remind me of? And then suddenly I realized, you know, I rushed to the old German books that I keep in my on my shelves just to remind me of the horrors of Nazism. And I found it there. It was a manual for SS servicemen operating in Russia. The manual said, a subhuman is only by appearance biologically similar to you. In reality, it is a very different creation of nature. It has hands, it has feet, it has a kind of brain, eyes, and mouth. But spiritually and psychologically, it is further from it is further removed from us than any animal. So, not everyone that has a human appearance is actually human. Woe to those who forget it. End of quote. So basically, the SS manual said the same thing which Mr. Macron said about journalists. The SS manual denied the human nature to people who disagreed with Nazi ideology. I mean, the SS manual did not say that, for example, Italians are subhumans or Japanese. Why? Because Italians and Japanese were allies of Hitler's ideology. Right. So, you know, Russians, other Slavs, Jews, Roma people, they were called subhumans, mostly because they happened to oppose the Nazi ideology. And what does Mr. Macron say? You know, he never mentioned a single fact, you know, a single situation where RT or Sputnik would just get their facts wrong, where they would say untruths. He can't find it. What drives him crazy is the fact that these platforms, RT and Sputnik, they give voice to the people who are opposed to Emmanuel Macron's ideology, to ultra-liberalism. So if these people give voice to his opponents, these people are not journalists. Just like the opponents of Hitler's regime were not human to SS servicemen, in the same way opponents to Macron's, Clinton's, you know, Mrs. May ideologies, they are not human. They are denied the right to have human nature.
You know, you also have, this echoes to me, Nazi Germany and Goebbels in particular. I'm looking at, you know, France24.com website. And in the story about this, it says, asked about the alleged Russian hacking attempts to influence the French election, Putin was indignant, then evasive. Now, listen to how he's indignant, then evasive. Quote, this is President Putin. You asked the following, quote, it is said, close quote, there was, quote, perhaps, close quote, some interference by Russian hackers. How can I comment on such a thing, close quote. That's from President Putin. Then he adds, quote, perhaps there were Russian hackers at work, perhaps not, close quote. In other words, he's mocking the use of perhaps by these people, framing a question with maybe this happened and maybe not. And he's saying, I can't answer a speculative question. Ask me something and I can answer it. And then he uses their form to spit it back. And that is characterized as, and they don't give the actual Russian comments for someone to try to parse it on their own. And it says, Putin was indignant, then evasive. That's how they describe
evasive,
what you just heard.
Yes. Evasive, that is anyone who disagrees with them. He or she is evasive.
I would say sarcasm and irony, right? He was being sarcastic,
absolutely.
Of course, and
he
ironic.
He was being sarcastic, ironic. And Americans know this story very well because I think for more than a year now, you have been violated by this constant stream of news about the Congress and the U.S. Special Services just about to show you the evidence of this so-called Russian hacking, Russian interference. And somehow they never come up with it, but they keep promising.
Right.
Oh, there is Mr. Mueller at work. You know, he indicted Mr. Manafort, who actually, you know, the truth is that Mr. Manafort, for big bucks, worked for the presidential electoral campaign of the Ukrainian president, the ousted Ukrainian president Viktor Yanukovych. Yanukovych was actually not a big friend of Russia. He wanted his own Ukrainian business to get kind of diluted in the European business. He wanted what I would call a European registration, a Western registration for his billions.
Right.
And Mr. Manafort helped him to become the president, and Mr. Right. Manafort tried to orient Yanukovych towards the United States to make him a pawn of the United States. And the irony is that for this, he may get a long jail sentence.
Right, as a Russian agent and spy or whatever. In other words, what he was doing was helping to steal Ukraine from being a Russian ally to being an American colony. And for that, he's going to go to jail for being a Russian agent.
Well, the problem is that he became a victim of U.S. propaganda, in the sense that he believed it.
Yeah.
He is not an idiot to believe it. The problem is that the U.S. propaganda made Yanukovych what he wasn't.
Right, that's right.
They presented him as a Russian puppet, as some kind of Putin's incarnation in Kiev, which is totally untrue.
It's the opposite,
Yes, but when they needed someone, some kind of a sacrificial victim, you know, to show that we found someone, they're going to put that guy in jail, they couldn't find anyone except Mr. Manafort.
Right, that's right. I know, it's amazing.
And it's just amazing. And the story continues. We keep getting all these promises. Just to wait. Just tomorrow, just the day after tomorrow, they will show the evidence. It will be crushing. You know, the editor of BuzzFeed had the shamelessness, you know, to publish an article 1 year after they made public this so-called Christopher Steele's report about, I'm sorry, the Russian prostitutes allegedly peeing on Mr. Trump on a hotel bed that previously had belonged to Mr. Obama and his wife.
Right.
So he published all of that crap. Instead of being ashamed,
I know.
He now publishes.
He's a hero. They were talking about him in Congress the other day. So
yes, saying that he had the courage to publish all of that crap, like no one had it, but he had the guts, he saved the United States from a huge misfortune, because all 12 months after he published that, all the U.S. media kept being filled with reports about this so-called Russian influence.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's like a race of shamelessness, you know. Who is more shameless? The opinion editor of the New York Times? Oh, no. The opinion editor of the Washington Post? Oh, no. Right. The BuzzFeed guys?
They
are the most shameless.
So, let me ask you a question. As a journalist, have you ever had the occasion to listen to some White House tapes like Nixon's, like, in other words, to hear the audio quality of the White House taping system that like Nixon and LBJ used? Have you ever heard any of those tapes?
I didn't take the time to listen to them in full, but of course I know the story of Watergate and of Daniel Ellsberg's papers.
Well, I'm thinking quality. They're very, to me, and I'm an audio engineer, they're very difficult to hear because the mic placement is, you know, random depending on where people are standing in the room and all of that. It's an old style tape recorder. You can hear kind of noises in it and everything.
Yeah.
So, now, if you think about what Watergate was, you had a couple knuckleheads breaking into this hotel where the Democratic Committee was headquartered, and they were trying to plant these kind of bugs so that Nixon's people, their staff, could have recordings of that quality listening to a busy campaign office. In other words, not exactly like having a copy of every communication, phone call, everything else. It's going to be a tape, and you hope you get lucky. Well, and that Nixon gets driven out of office over that ultimately. People go to jail for years and years, even with presidential pardons, some of them. And that's then, 1973, 74, 75. Here we have this BuzzFeed releasing this thing, that report going to the FBI, that being used, we now know for fact, used to induce a FISA warrant that allows the Justice Department under Obama, which is still the high brass acting pretty much under President Obama, to wiretap the campaign, Trump's campaign. That was with the government doing that role instead of, you know, four knuckleheads. That's what's happening now. And not the one they're talking about going to jail is the one being bugged instead of the one doing the bugging.
Exactly. I mean, it's too bad that the name of that BuzzFeed editor who published this proud opinion piece in the New York Times, it's too bad his name is Ben Smith. I'm sure there are many nice Ben Smiths in the United States who have to suffer now because they have the same first and second name as Ben Smith. This example of human species. I'm not going to use the same language as people who Mr. Macron imitates. But certainly that guy, I wouldn't call him a journalist, even though he might be playing with a mic. And he actually doesn't need a mic, you know. Right. He publishes stories about prostitutes being on Mr. Trump. He publishes the materials commissioned by the Democratic National Campaign to a former MI6 spy. Okay, if you publish this stuff, you are not a journalist. And you actually don't need tape recorders, micros. You know, it's just enough to have a large sling and put, you know, various substances into that sling. And that's all that you need as a journalist, or rather a writer. Right. But anyway, I think the fact that you mentioned is just astounding. There are kind of more obvious facts for me. I can just imagine how they would call Daniel Ellsberg, who published the Pentagon Papers. Mm. I can easily picture how the New York Times publishes a story about Daniel Ellsberg stealing these papers, stealing them from the nice little government that we have, the defenseless Pentagon officials, and publishing them in the interests of Putin or Brezhnev or whoever was in charge in Moscow at the time, and all of these university intellectuals, all of these media specialists, all thousands of them, listening to it, swallowing it, and saying that they enjoy it, you know.
You know, on this point also, that, you know, as you said, here in the United States, we're promised that, you know, here comes the evidence. Here, it's any minute. I'm looking at this same, you know, France24.com piece, and it says, and this is from last May, I think, a Trend Micro report released in late April said the cybersecurity group was, quote, 99% sure, closed quote, that Russian hackers were targeting Macron's campaign. They don't offer any evidence. It's another one of these assessments that, well, we're 99% sure. Now, look over it next to France, back to Germany, and they're forming a new government there. But we've had the same thing there, that there's tampering by Russia in their elections and all of this, and there's no evidence of any of that. And left to their own devices, because I don't think anyone's accusing Russia of tampering with the attempt to put together a government in Germany, they seem to have their own problems without Russia or anybody else.
My friend, I'm sorry, but you are behind the news. The Russian government was accused this week by McMaster of interfering with the Mexican election, which is still to happen, but Russia has already interfered.
Well, they must have a time machine or something.
Today we had the latest warnings about Russians interfering in the Italian and the Serbian elections, which are also yet to happen. And about the German election, believe me, during all of the first 9 months of 2017 and even before that, there were constant stories in the German, American, British, French media accusing Russia of somehow trying to damage Mrs. Merkel and her chances of becoming the chancellor again. I noticed that when she was lagging behind in opinion polls, the suspicions became more loud, like they were hedging their bets. If heaven forbid, she loses, then they were ready to ascribe it to Russians. When she was ahead in the polls again, suddenly, the German intelligence officials themselves came out and said that you know, these suspicions were not proven. We have made the checks. We didn't find anything. So in fact, they didn't find anything. In fact, I'm sure Russia did not interfere, even probably should, because Mrs. Merkel said that our president lived in a different world. You know, just like Mr. Cameron, who accused us of interfering in the Brexit vote and in general of disliking him. Don't forget that he compared Putin to Adolf Hitler, Russia to Nazi Germany. Mrs. Clinton, who called Putin, let me quote it, the godfather of extreme nationalisms in the world. Mm-hmm. Later on, she was dismayed by the fact that the Russian media somehow liked her less than Trump. and somehow in general was not sympathetic towards her. Okay. And Mr. Putin, he was so bad. She said that his election was neither free nor fair, and he had the dishonesty to say the same about her and her defeat, you know. Right. Actually, now she is saying that her defeat was neither free nor fair,
right? That's right, that's
right. Because she keeps questioning the election.
Yep.
And Trump is, I think Trump is in an idiotic position right now, because what can he say to Putin after all of this pressure from the New York Times and the Washington Post? What can he ask Putin? Can he ask him just to stop telling me that I won honestly? You know, say that I won dishonestly with your help.
You know,
that is kind of an idiotic situation, you know.
For me,
the New York.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The New York Times wants Mr. Trump to call his own election dishonest.
Right.
You know, you know, the Nazis were awful hypocrites, and they forced people to do all kinds of bad things. But even they didn't try to force, say, you know, the former French Prime Minister, Léon Blum, who was Jewish. They didn't force him to say that he was elected dishonestly, and that the communists stole his election.
Right.
So the United States, in its current form and in its current ideology of ultra-liberalism, went further ahead down the path of absurdity than even the Nazi detractors of Léon Blum.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, I'm looking at what's been going on in the United States now for the last year and a half, and also in Europe, you know, around the Brexit vote, around the French vote, around the German vote. I mean, no one here mentions the fact that, you know, Merkel's been chancellor for 12 years, and that maybe the reason she's not popular is because of what she's done over the last 12 years.
And of course, Putin, you know, when he stayed the president for 8 years, that was like a hell of a lot of time for the Western media. Mm. And they speculated whether he was going to run himself. Mm. They were prepared to start a rebellion in Russia in case he doesn't hand power to someone else. And he actually chose Mr. Medvedev as his successor later on. But 12 years with Mrs. Merkel is fine. 8 years with Putin is awful, right?
Right, that's right. And with Obama, too. Obama was fine 8 years. So, let's see. They're trying to form the government. Let's talk about what's actually happening there, too, and what it might mean for Russia and peace, generally.
Well, I think that the German Social Democratic Party is going through a terrible humiliation right now, because their leader, who is actually no better than Mrs. Merkel, you know, Martin Schulz, the former chairman of the European Parliament. Their leader has said several times after very bad election results, you know, this September, that he would not form a coalition with Mrs. Merkel, that the Social Democratic Party was damaged by several years of the so-called big coalition with Mrs. Merkel and her Christian Democrats. He kept saying it, only to say now that finally, after weighing all the options, he decided that it was possible, right? And you don't need a crystal ball. You can see lots of, you know, fat cats, big business leaders, U.S. officials, NATO officials, EU officials. You can see them all pushing Mr. Schulz towards forming a coalition with Chancellor Merkel. And this is so awful, because everyone understands it's going to kill the remnants of the Social Democratic Party's popularity. Social Democratic Party is the oldest party in Germany, which has a glorious history. I mean, there were some dark spots on it, like in the 20s when 30. Basically the Noske, who was a Social Democratic Interior Minister, he brutally cracked down on a leftist rebellion in Germany. So there were black spots, but in general, you know, their fight against Nazism, their participation in the post-war reconstruction of Germany, their non-acceptance of the regime in East Germany, which you know, finally cracked up not to be as democratic as a lot of people expected in the late 40s. So they had a glorious history, and now you can see how they're surrendering it. Actually, the German liberals, the so-called Free Democratic Party, they have just been destroyed by several years of coalition with Chancellor Merkel. Their leader, Guido Westerwelle, when he was the foreign minister in Merkel's government, he went to Kiev to speak to the protesting crowds on Maidan. Not even protesting, but, throwing Molotov cocktails. And that is not interference in Ukraine's affairs. Right. That doesn't need to be investigated by special services of Ukraine or Russia or Germany. That is fine. But rumors about Russian hackers, that is really dangerous.
Right.
So actually, the liberals were destroyed by their experience with Merkel. So she is kind of toxic. You know, what he does, she makes alliances with various parties, and she destroys their reputation.
Yep.
She already did it to the liberals. She did it to the Greens. Now she's going to basically to finish the Social Democrats. Yeah. 3 or 4 years with her, and they're done.
I want to discuss that further next week after we see how this shakes out. And really appreciate your time, Dmitry, and be well. Okay?
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Indivisible security in Europe has been a diplomatic talking point for decades, but the lack of agreement on what it means or how to bring it about has contributed to a number of conflicts, including the one in Ukraine. Has the violence in Donbas effectively buried the idea of security for all, or has it on the contrary made it more viable? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Thomas Graminger, the new Secretary General of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Mr. Graminger, thank you very much for your time. It's been roughly since months since you accepted that position, pledging to reinvigorate the organization, to specifically focus on dialogue and reviving trust. I wonder if the practical reality of the past 6 months has perhaps dampened your ambition?
Not at all. I think when I assumed this office, I knew very well what was expecting me. I'm quite familiar with the OSCE to one of my previous jobs. I was the Swiss permanent representative to the OSCE and to the UN here in Vienna for 5 years. I chaired the Permanent Council in 2014. I chaired it when we started to deal with the crisis in and around Ukraine. So I'm very familiar with this institution. I'm familiar with its processes.
And you're familiar with the challenges that
it currently faces.
You often talk about the restoration of trust as the key to the OSCE's effectiveness. But what makes you believe that the organization's stakeholders have reached the point when they value that trust over their immediate policy objectives?
Look, I think one of, if not the key challenge in Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian security these days is this historic deficit of trust between stakeholders. And basically, we need a platform for inclusive dialogue. We need a place where we can gradually rebuild trust among the key stakeholders. And I think this takes us in a way a bit back to the origins of the CEC when it was created to manage these very difficult East-West relations during the Cold War.
Now, those very difficult East-West relations deteriorated even further in Ukraine. And I know that you made Ukraine the first country that you visited in your official capacity. This is also was the place where the trust or whatever had been left of it, broke down completely. I think over the efforts to either preserve or change Ukraine's geopolitical standing, do you think at this point of time, 4 years into that conflict, the sides have come to the readiness to sort of harmonize the stances or the geopolitical ambitions?
Not yet. I mean, if you look at the total impasse in implementing the Minsk agreements, I'm not seeing the political commitment that would be necessary to get out of this current stalemate. I mean, on the positive side, I think what we have managed successfully, and here the OEC contributed, I think, very significantly, is we managed to prevent a further escalation of the conflict. But of course, we would want to resolve this conflict. And for this, I think we need the political commitment to implement both sets of clauses, the security-related provisions and the political provisions of the Minsk agreements.
But with all due respect, I think whether or not the conflict escalates further depends not so much on the OSCE, even though the mission is highly appreciated, but on the actual parties or the international backers. I heard you state in one of your interviews that you regret the return of zero-sum mentality into European security. And I heard other experts suggest that the conflict is in Ukraine is actually unique in being a lose-lose situation, which makes the parties compete not over how much they gain, but actually how much they make the other side lose. And when you look at that from that perspective, the potential for hostilities actually hasn't been exhausted. It goes far beyond Ukraine. And this is what I want to ask you about at this point. Do you think this conflict is contained to Ukraine or its southern eastern part? Or do you think it can still go further than that?
Well, I think the conflict as such is typical of a situation that we've gotten into after two decades of relative stability, of rule-based security order in Europe that is now more and more put into question. And in that sense, the Georgian conflict in 2008 was a first indicator of that. And in a way, the crisis in around Ukraine is another symptom of this underlying fundamental problem that we face in European security.
Well, if I may bring you back to the question that I just posed about whether you think the conflict can expand beyond the current war theater, I think it's clear that there are sort of two tracks to that conflict. One is kinetic on the battlefield, and the other one is by inflicting economic or diplomatic pressure. And I'm sure you know that the United States is about to introduce another round of sanctions against Russia, of which Ukraine is highly supportive, though formally speaking, it has nothing to do with Ukraine. Do you think that kind of economic pressure, that kind of remote well, I wouldn't call it war, but still the efforts to apply pressure to each other, do you think it could have a direct impact on the battlefield?
For me, the relevant sets of clauses that we have on the table are the Minsk agreements. And I think it's them that we need to implement. That's very clear. There are a number of underlying issues that can only be addressed once we have implemented them, once we have sorted out the current crisis in and around Ukraine. But I think there is absolutely no way around doing that.
You often point out that you believe that there is no way around the Minsk agreement, and yet I'm sure you know that many in Ukraine believe that that deal was reached under duress and therefore should not be implemented. I know you met President Poroshenko recently. I wonder if you have any ideas on how to incentivize him to publicly accept the validity of the Minsk agreement, which he cannot afford to do or hasn't done publicly within the Ukrainian environment so far, or perhaps to incentivize him to look for other alternative solutions?
Look, I think this is a conflict that is extremely expensive to all sides. All sides would profit from implementing the Minsk agreements. And I think the trick is this is a complex set of security and politically related provisions. And we need to agree on a roadmap on how to proceed in implementing them. And I think once, of course, the more progress we make in establishing a sustainable ceasefire in the Donbas, the easier it is, obviously, for President Poroshenko to sell also the political provisions back home. I'm fully aware that this is not obvious.
Now, I know that you personally were involved in negotiating the scope for the OSCE special monitoring mission, which, as it has been suggested, may need to be complemented by an armed UN mission. And it seems that the disagreements over the scope of the UN mission have been narrowed down over the past month. At least Russia says that it no longer objects to the UN monitors having access to the entire war theater, but provided that Kyiv and the breakaway republics agree to that in direct talks. How big of a hurdle you think that letter requirement would be? Do you think Kyiv could bring itself to engage directly with the breakaway republics on that specific point of the UN mission?
I think there is indeed a potential to kind of come out of this impasse of implementing the Minsk agreements by agreeing on a UN peace operation. But as you have alluded to, there is still quite a gap between the concepts that we have formally.
But I don't see quite a gap between the concepts, because what I see is Russia actually changing its position on the scope of the UN mission, and Kyiv still sticking to its original points. And some in Moscow suspect that this is a way actually of not implementing, another pretext for not implementing the Minsk agreement. Because if you are interested in peace, why is it such a problem to sit down with the breakaway regions again? They did that within the Minsk format, so why not do it again?
I still see the sides camping on initial positions that are quite far away, but I do see a potential of narrowing the gap, and I do hope that Mr. Surkov and Mr. Volker will eventually manage to close the gap. Obviously, should this happen, the OSCE would be very keen to be associated to any planning of such an operation from the very outset. After all, we've been now working in the area for 3 years, and we are also, I think, in a position to contribute all the civilian assets to such an operation.
Now, German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel said just earlier this month that Germany, together with France, would promote this idea at the UN Security Council, of which Ukraine is not a member. And I want to ask you, as a former and perhaps a current diplomat as well, where do you think that deal on the UN mission should and would be hammered out? Is it among the Ukrainian parties or principally among their international backers?
No, I think if there is no buy-in by the sides, it will not work out. There needs to be a common understanding first by the sides of the type of operation that we want then to negotiate more formally. Clearly, the sides need to be part of that. They need to own what has come out of this exercise of narrowing the current gap.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kyiv still emphasizes that it does not want to see any Russian CSTO or CIS troops among the peacekeepers. And I think even in Russia, some people would fully understand the reluctance to see the Russians. But do you think the idea of excluding all or most of the neighboring countries is sensible? And consecutively, you chair a pretty large organization. Which of the members could be perceived as neutral parties by all the sides?
Well, I think we are not there yet. And I think it's also not up to the OSCE then to exclude or include specific contributing countries.
But you can offer an advice.
This is very sensitive. Politically, what contributing countries will eventually offer troops, there is no doubt about it. And I think there has been a tradition in UN peacekeeping that states that have a direct stake in a given conflict should not be part of the troop contributors. And I wouldn't see why we shouldn't stick to that principle.
But what about the neighbors, like countries like Kazakhstan or even Belarus, which hosted the Minsk agreements? Should they be considered as somebody who has a stake in those conflicts or somebody who has an expertise both with the Russians and with the Ukrainians?
Well, at the end of the day, I think it's up to the sides to decide to whom they have confidence and to whom they have not.
Well, Mr. Greminger, we have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Thomas Greminger, Secretary General of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Mr. Greminger, let's broaden our discussion a little bit. I heard one official in Moscow say that the next few years, or more to be precise, your term, will determine whether the OSCE becomes a more relevant international body or whether it ceases to exist altogether. Do you agree with such a stark formulation?
Well, it would, of course, put huge expectations on my term. And I'm not so sure that I would like this. But, of course, I'm ambitious. And I know it's extremely important to position this organization as the relevant platform for inclusive dialogue. And for common action on all relevant security issues in the OSCE area. And if not, the organization will gradually become obsolete. In that sense, I agree, the stakes are high.
I just want to seize on what you just said, and I heard you say before that you want to build the OSCE into the relevant forum for security dialogue in the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian space. And that's an interesting formulation in and of itself, because to many decision makers in the Euro-Atlantic community, the very concept of the Eurasian space as a separate economic and geopolitical entity is offensive. What exactly do you mean by the Eurasian space?
Well, I think this, by the way, is very much the formulation used by the Astana Summit Declaration in 2010, that the OSCE is about the creation of a common security space in the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian area. And if you look at some of the security challenges that we are currently facing, just look at counterterrorism, violent extremism. The Central Asian states are extremely keen to get OSCE expertise, to use the OSCE as a platform for exchange on best practices, to get the OSCE also to encourage other participating states to cooperate more.
Mr. Greminger, what I mean by my question is that I think there is absolutely no secret that many in the United States in particular see any efforts to deepen economic or security integration among former Soviet states as a sort of stepping stone towards the recreation of the Soviet Union in its geopolitical role. This is what former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talked about in very disapproving terms. This is what many people in the United States believe. And for them, Europe, you know, their conception of Europe is whole, free. They would say at peace, but in Russia, people would interpret as under the American heel. And to many in the United States and in the West more generally, Russia is a spoiler that is trying to destroy this beautiful vision of Europe, whole, free, and under the American influence. Can you tell me authoritatively that you have never came across that kind of formulation in your work as the OSCE Secretary General?
Well, what I can assure you of is that the OSCE wants participating states to be free to choose in what trade alliance they want to enter, without then necessarily losing out on trading.
Have you ever been accused of speaking like Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov? Because this is exactly what he would say.
I'm trying to be impartial. I'm offering the OSCE as a middle ground. My sense is that this is being appreciated by both sides.
By both sides or by all sides?
It's, of course, more complicated. It's more than just the East and the West. If you look at the security narratives that have been established in the last 20 years, you see clearly different narratives. You see also the narratives of the in-between countries. They have a different view, a different security narrative. And I think the OSCE is a platform that provides space for dialogue to all sides.
This is a very interesting question as far as the OSCE's core purpose is concerned, because when the organization was created during the Cold War as the East-West Forum, the trust between the sides was also very low. But at that point of time, their right to their own worldview was recognized. I wonder if in a certain way you are actually talking about taking the OSCE to its very origins, when this organization would be a forum for negotiating those fundamental viewpoint differences, rather than being sort of a compliance club for, or a monitoring compliance club for one vision, which is the Euro-Atlantic vision, which I think was the case for this organization in the late 1990s and early 2000s.
Well, I think we have a set of principles and commitments that all participating states need to stick to. And the OSCE is indeed, when it comes to these principles and commitments, a monitoring platform. But we should definitely not stop there, because interestingly enough, there is no fundamental questioning of these principles and commitments, but we obviously have to develop different understandings of what these principles mean. And again, the conflicts in Georgia and the crisis in around Ukraine are a case in point. We need to build a unifying agenda where we can gradually rebuild trust and confidence. And then at some point in time, we may then reach a level of trust that would allow us to get back to these more fundamental issues. But for the time being, I think it's about incremental progress. It's also very much about solving the crisis in around Ukraine before we can then address these more fundamental issues again.
Mr. Grevinger, we focus mostly on the issues involving Russia so far, but I think there are other countries, like, for example, Turkey, or even some states within the EU that no longer want to be sort of folded into the West, that have their own issues with the way Western community interprets human rights, democracy, security, what have you. And I'm sure you would say that that calls even for more dialogue. But I wonder, how would you define dialogue at this point? And would the current mode of communication within the OSCE bodies qualify as dialogue?
The OSCE offers different dialogue forums. You have the formal ones, the Permanent Council. This is, of course, very much also a public diplomacy a platform where states are held accountable. I think this is necessary, but again, it's not enough. And I think the unique opportunity the OSCE offers is there is lots of informal space for dialogue. Again, an example, there has now been this structured dialogue established on political military issues. I think a very successful, serious platform that is very much appreciated.
Well, it's only been 1 year in existence, perhaps even less than that. It was offered by the Germans just last year. Do you think it has really demonstrated any practical successes?
Well, if you look at, for the time being, it's a platform that is appreciated, that it is attended by representatives from capitals, by the ambassadors here, and that under current circumstances I would already consider as a success. But you're right, but you're absolutely right, at some point in time of course this platform will have to produce results. But I think when you look at the discussions held last year on threat perceptions, on military risk reduction, there is now this common understanding that we need a mapping of military capabilities that has started now, is ongoing, is an important endeavor. And I do hope that at some point in time, this structured dialogue will lead to very concrete military risk reduction measures, will lead to a new understanding of how to implement current confidence and security building measures, and eventually and hopefully also to a decision to revise the current set of confidence and security building measures.
Let me squeeze one more question, which is crucial for us. You know that one area of tensions is the situation with media freedoms. I'm sure you've heard that about the difficulties that Russian media experience in Europe and the United States. A number of American media organizations are facing restrictions in Russia. And I think at the core of all those disagreements is the notion that some media could be labeled as free and others could be labeled as wild propagandists, like, for example, the channel that I represent. And the latter ones, the idea is that the latter ones have to be outlawed. And I think that's a very new thing, a very new phenomenon. We didn't have it during the Cold War. We didn't have countries like, for example, France or the United States actually putting forward legislative measures to ban the expression of opinion. Do you think the OSCE at this point of time realistically can has the capacity to influence how this whole thing unfolds, or are you essentially reduced to expressing your concern and regret?
Well, let me start by underlining how important freedom of expression, freedom of speech is. There are basic human rights. There are fundamental pillars of any democratic society. The OSCE has an institution, a special institution that deals with media freedom, and that is the representative for the freedom of the media. This is Mr. Alain Désir, and he seized of these issues.
Yeah, but
and
so far he has only expressed regret at certain violations of media freedom. For example, in Latvia, when Russian journalists were, for no apparent or communicated reason, sent out of the country, but he didn't do much to rectify this.
Well, he does a lot. He has two sets of tools. He has the tools of public diplomacy and has the tools of silent diplomacy. I see both. And I can assure you that he is very much engaged. He's concerned about these issues, and he works on them very hard.
Previously, the OSCE had to sort of preach to former Soviet states, former communist states, or states that were deemed to be violators of press and media freedoms to sort of comply with the established norms. But now we see one Western country after another, the champions, the purported champions of media freedoms, to introduce measures that would limit those media freedoms. What's your reaction to that? And do you think that process in itself could be stopped or altered?
Again, coming back to the formal bodies of the OSCE, these are issues that are being brought up in the permanent council of the OSCE. But I think in a more systematic way, it is the OSCE institution, the representative on the freedom of media, that deals with it and tries to shape decision-making in respective participating states.
Well, Mr. Greiminger, this is all we have time for. I really appreciate your being on the show. And to our viewers, please keep the conversation going on our social media pages, and I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.